From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As much as 2020 has tilted the world sideways, one thing doesn't change for Detroiters: the realities of gun violence.
A lot of priorities have changed, but the prevalence of gun violence hasn't really gone away, and it hasn't really left people's minds.
Today, the voices of three women who've lost children to the city's other epidemic. Also, changes afoot for the program created to help people rejoin their communities after prison.
A lot of folks need trauma-specific therapies, and if that's not what is being offered, I don't think it's really going to get to the core of the problem that creates mass incarceration, which is intergenerational trauma.
And today we catch up with new developments in collegiate competitive gaming. Some Big Ten schools are finally getting their own programs.
If you have the ability to pay for your education at a school like the University of Michigan, of course it's an avenue that many kids would take.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a conversation about the developing future of esports in Michigan.
COVID shut down sports for, you know, half a year. And I think the ability to be able to still engage with a student body and, you know, have your brand out there as a university, esports was a vital, you know, tool for that.
That's later in the program. But first, the confluence of truly devastating news this year has blown apart most Michiganders' sense of normalcy. In Detroit, there's one constant that sadly has not changed very much. Even with the pandemic, an economic crash, and months of Black Lives Matter protests underway. And that's the recitation of injuries and deaths that have happened due to gun violence. The FBI's annual report on crime in the United States was released on Monday for 2019 data, and in it, Detroit's rate of violent crimes leads the nation. We should say, overall, crime was down 12%, but homicides and non-fatal shootings were both up from the year prior. We can talk for a long time about statistics, but there is another way to understand what's going on in Detroit and other Michigan cities. Bryce Huffman of Bridge Detroit recently published an oral history of three women united in loss, their children claimed by gun violence. Here's part of his story.
Francesca was a bundle of joy.
This is Sherry Scott. She's telling me about her daughter, Francesca Marks.
She knew everybody in the neighborhood. She knew everybody's business in the neighborhood. Everybody knew her. I knew none of these people. So I was labeled Frankie's mom. She went by Frankie.
Frankie had her first baby at 19. She went on to have seven kids total. Frankie's favorite thing to do with her kids was take them to the park. She would put food on the grill and let them run around. Unfortunately, on a nice warm day last August, Frankie took her kids to the wrong park. She and the kids heard gunshots nearby.
She turned around to get her baby. That's how she got shot.
Just like that, Sherry Scott lost her daughter, and seven kids lost their mom. Her youngest kids are so young, they won't remember her when they grow up. Unfortunately, Frankie Marks is just one of the many people to die from gun violence in Detroit. As of September 1st, there have been 215 homicides in Detroit this year. Last year ended with 273 homicides. With all those murders, it can be hard to focus on what one family loses every time. But please, take a moment. Frankie was one of 273 murders. This story isn't about law enforcement or campaigns to end violence. This story is about mothers who lost their children. This story is about loss. Scott has only had about a year to process this loss. But what about mothers who have had more time to grieve? Justine Thornhill has had 11 years to think about losing her oldest son. His name was Justin. He was shot and killed while trying to buy a used car in 2009, just 2 days before enrolling in community college classes. He was 19 years old. Thornhill says the week of the shooting was especially hard for her.
Just hurt, angry, you know, wishing that I could reverse it like Superman did Lois Lane, but I knew I couldn't do that.
Despite these feelings, Thornhill says she tried her best to keep it all inside.
I had to be strong for my other three children because they were young.
Justin's brother, who was 9 at the time of the shooting, started lashing out in school.
I had to pull him out of school and have him online school because he was getting like D's and E's.
Eventually, the family began to adjust to their new normal, a world without Justin. But it took a lengthy trial that saw the gunman and his accomplice serve time before that happened. Thornhill says after a while, she forgave the people responsible for Justin's death.
So I had to forgive because at the end of the day, it's like they were, you know, they were young. They were somebody kids as well. You know what I'm saying? So I couldn't wish, you know, harm on them. You know, although they put, you know, they brought harm to our family. They brought harm to my, you know, my son. It's like I forgave.
She says she was able to forgive because the case had closure. She knows who killed Justin and she knows what happened to them. But that's not a luxury everyone has.
And there's no closure because we don't know what happened, why it happened.
This is Doris Fleming. Back in 2001, her daughter, a retired Detroit police officer, was picking up clothes from the dry cleaners. That's when she was gunned down by an unknown assailant. Her name was Sherilyn Fleming. The shooting happened nearly 20 years ago, but to her, it feels like the shooting was yesterday.
Every day I think about it. Not a day that doesn't go by. And I just wondered, why did this happen to her?
In the background, you can hear Sherilyn's best friend fidgeting with plastic candy wrappers. She takes care of Doris now that she's older. She declined to be interviewed, but got up during the interview several times to cry or grab tissues. Fleming says the wound still feels fresh to people who were close to Sherilyn, but she thinks most people have forgotten about the shooting. She says the police haven't brought it up in years.
You know, you wonder, they don't even call you, or they don't say anything about it, or say, well, we're working on it, or we got some leak. There's nothing. Just nothing.
Fleming says on most days, she wonders what her daughter might look like if she were still alive.
Doesn't day go by that I don't think about her. It's something that'll go on in here that I'll do, and I'll think, I guess Sherilyn would be doing this today, or she would be doing that today, you know.
Sherilyn would be 72 if she were alive today. She never got to grow old with her best friend or her mom. This kind of loss is common in Detroit. Sherry Scott, Frankie's mom, says people need to think more and shoot less.
Just stop the violence. Literally stop the violence. Because we're killing our people, you know? And then they had left these kids here with no mother. This wasn't, whatever they was fighting over wasn't worth those kids losing their mom.
That story was produced by Bridge Detroit's Bryce Huffman. And he's with us now to talk more about his reporting on the story. Why did you want to talk about the toll of gun violence in this moment?
Well, it all started in a Bridge Detroit editorial meeting. We were talking about the rise in gun violence this summer and how just about everyone in Detroit either knows someone who has died from gun violence or someone who has been shot. And one of the things we were talking about is the lack of stories that just focus on that loss. You know, Detroit media does a really good job of talking about what the police are going to do about crime or talking about a shooting the night it happens or the day after. But, you know, once that moment is gone, you know, the light on that family's loss is largely ignored.
As I mentioned, a lot of things have changed for us this year. But do you think that gun violence has ever really left the priority list for Detroiters if we were to ask them about priorities in the city?
I don't think so. Like you said, this year has been constant change in so many different ways that a lot of priorities have changed, but the prevalence of gun violence hasn't really gone away and it hasn't really left people's minds.
Yeah. The three mothers that you talked to, what were the things that had to happen for them to talk to you about their grief?
It really was a matter of getting them comfortable to talk about something that no one wants to talk about. No mother wants to talk about or even think about their child being killed. But I think through my ability to just meet people where they're at, I got these mothers to talk about a subject that is just really difficult, you know?
Yeah. What did you notice in the way that they spoke about ways that grief hits them?
I think the thing I noticed most as someone who's young and I don't have any kids myself, the emotions went from happy to sad in a flash. You know, it would go from, you know, me asking them what their kid was like and them having a smile on their face while remembering fondly for instance, Sherry Scott talked about how her daughter liked to make barbecue a lot. And it went from very lighthearted and fun to talking about the week of the shooting. And that transition for each of the mothers was something that I picked up on when I was doing the interview. So although, you know, there were moments where we were celebrating the life of their kid who has passed, there was still a very heavy heartedness to the conversation overall. And the different questions that I would ask would kind of bring out those different emotions in each of the mothers.
Hmm. Bryce, who were you hoping would hear the story or read it in the online iterations?
I was hoping, honestly, anyone from Detroit who either knew someone who was a victim of gun violence or someone who is really new to the topic would read this. I think the thing about this piece is that people can relate to it on all fronts because everyone has lost someone before their time, I think, whether it was to gun violence or whether it was to illness or a car accident. Everyone knows what that feeling is like. So I was really hoping anyone who has experienced loss would read this.
You know, there's some kinds of stories, like you say, that are issue oriented, trying to get to the heart of something that's emerging. And then there are some stories when all you can do is just sort of witness. What do you think the value is for Detroiters who have lost someone to have someone witness, yes, this happened, this loss is still with me every day?
I think it's just relatable to people. So many times when we hear stories about gun violence, the angle is always, what is law enforcement doing to stop it? Or what are community activists doing to bring attention to it? But I think sometimes that kind of diminishes the feeling that the family has. And we really wanted to highlight that not only do these three families understand this feeling, but so many people across the city and across the country, quite frankly, have had to deal with the loss due to gun violence.
Bryce Huffman is a reporter for Bridge Detroit. You can read his story online about three mothers united in their grief. Bryce, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, what the closure of Detroit's reentry center means for prisoners transitioning back into society after serving their time.
So we have this huge aging population in Michigan, and that we have to have a dialysis unit is a big question for us as citizens to ponder.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Every year since 2012, thousands of people have passed through the Detroit Reentry Center. The name is a bit misleading. Some prisoners are housed there, especially ones who are soon scheduled to rejoin their communities. Probationers are also in residence, and it's a place where the state sends parolees who violated conditions for their release. The hastily crafted state budget that Michigan's leaders passed recently will spare most of our state agencies from major cutbacks. But one of the casualties is the reentry center. It's going to be closing in January. Natalie Holbrook is with us today. She's program director for the American Friends Service Committee's Michigan Criminal Justice Program. Natalie, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
Natalie, what went through your mind when you heard that MDOC was closing the reentry center?
Well, we're always glad when a prison closes and the work that we do, because we think that decarceration and closing prisons will lead to safer communities. So I wasn't surprised that it was the reentry center. There have only been about 70 people there in the last many months, and they've been moving towards a transition to close it. So it made sense. There are other prisons I would like to see closed more, but it did make sense.
Like you say, the population at the reentry center has been much lower than its full capacity. I think it can hold up to 700, and as many as 500 people have been housed there at its height. What's your understanding of what is going to happen to the programs that are housed there? It is at the Detroit Reentry Center. It's a residential treatment facility for some. For others, it's a place where vocational education has to happen. Is it your understanding that there will be opportunities comparable to what people had at the Detroit Reentry Center?
Yeah, they're going to continue to offer programs to folks. And then the dialysis folks that were living at Ryan will be moved, I'm pretty sure, to Woodland to get dialysis treatment. So I think everything will just happen at other facilities. Right now, programming is starting to run at some places where it had been shut down because of COVID. So there's been a big gap in program for the last many months. And I'm hopeful that programs will get up and running and that we won't have huge outbreaks, but we have no idea what's going to happen with this pandemic.
So the reentry center at one point was a full-fledged correction center, the Ryan Corrections Facility. And part of the logic of turning it into the reentry center, in addition to making for better relationships in its neighborhood, was that it might not be a bad idea to have a centralized location in the metro area where people might go if what they needed to get straight with were parole violations or other things that, you know, didn't require transport to one of the state's major prisons, which might be far away, something that might be closer to their homes, closer to their families. Is it your understanding that the same kind of opportunities the reentry center offers will still be available to folks with the new configuration?
Yes, I'm quite sure that the department will be providing the programming that people might need to complete or just to be held while they do their time on their violation. I'm hopeful that technical violations have been on the downturn since COVID, and bringing people back into the system doesn't make a lot of sense, especially with transmission of the virus. And then for folks that need programming, those programs will be at other prisons. So, and there used to be two prisons in Detroit. There was Mound Correctional and Ryan Correctional. And those prisons were closed without Detroit legislators knowing that they were going to be closed when they were closed many years ago. And there was a lot of pushback around, why would we take two prisons out of the community where people are landing from Wayne County? And AFSC applauds closures of prisons no matter what, but it wasn't necessarily the best geographic closure. And so having Ryan there did provide jobs for people in the community and created a way for people to not have to be moved around the state if they had a violation. It also, though, was a place where they were sending people to complete program. And I call it Band-Aid programming. So there's programs that the board wants to know that people have taken before they release them to the community. But if it happens 3 months or 6 months before they're released and they've been down for 7 years, I believe they should have been having the programming since the moment they hit the prison. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't quite make a lot of sense to me. And I think it's a good move now to just go back to having programs in the prison and hopefully moving in the other prisons and hopefully moving into a more rehabilitative way of treating people. Because when you land inside, you're technically not going to get any of the department sanctioned programs until you're within a year, maybe 18 months of your earliest release date. For Vocational Village, it might be a little bit different. You might have 2 years of programs, but they're only letting people into those programs in very few numbers. And you have to be under 2 years left in your sentence. And so I think that for me, it's called the Department of Corrections. And at times it can be more idle stuff happening. People aren't getting into programs till they're closer to their outdates. And I'm hopeful that one day we'll have a different model where people actually get good therapeutic programming all throughout their incarceration, if that's where they're going to have to go serve their punishment.
We should say that a portion of the population at the Detroit Reentry Center is there because they need dialysis. And I believe the plan is to move those services to a facility at Whitmore Lake, about 40 miles away. Do you foresee any consequences or ripple effect for those people and their families?
So I'm not sure of the makeup of the population at Ryan right now. And if folks are from Detroit, of course, it's going to be a little bit more of a long haul, but it's not like being sent over the bridge. So I don't foresee it being a terrible harm to families when visits open back up, because they're not happening right now. I do think that there's a bigger question here around, why do we keep people in prison who are on dialysis? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if there's a way to really get people moved to the community so that they can be with their families, that's what we would like to see happen, and stop treating people for very chronic and life-threatening health issues while they're in prison. So we have this huge aging population in Michigan, and that we have to have a dialysis unit is a big question for us as citizens to ponder, that people are sick and getting old inside and needing what is really actually expensive care the older they get.
Do you think that the center more or less served the purpose for which it was intended, preparing people to rejoin communities? I hear what you're saying, that the budget realities led to most people not getting any sort of rehabilitative services at all until late in their sentences.
I think that the purpose of putting people back into prison for parole violations is a slap on the wrist. It's not necessarily giving them programs in a 5-month period that are going to change their life forever. I think that people need a lot of support, community support, and they need loving care and arms around them. And a lot of folks need trauma-specific therapies. And if that's not what is being offered in programming, then I don't think it's really going to get to the core of the problem that creates mass incarceration, which is intergenerational trauma and intergenerational violence that is directly connected to legacies of slavery and systemic racism in this country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natalie Holbrook. She's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's Michigan Criminal Justice Program. Natalie, while I've got you with us, I did want to ask you about another project that you've been working on. It's a pair of bills that would raise the standards of care for pregnant women who are incarcerated in Michigan. Do we know how many women are in this circumstance right now?
Right now, there's only one pregnant woman at the Women's Huron Valley, which is a great thing. COVID has reduced the number of people entering the department at all. And so there's only one person that we're aware of that is pregnant. In the past years, though, the number of pregnant women has been on the rise. So it's been about 25 women a year who have been going through Huron Valley Women's and delivering babies while they are incarcerated.
As things stand, what is prenatal care like in Michigan's prisons?
So the Department of Corrections has an agreement with St. Joe's Hospital, and the OBGYNs and doctors and nurses at St. Joe's are really wonderful and have been trying to develop curriculum for staff training at the prison. There is a standard of care that is sort of interrupted by security. So what I mean by that is if you're a high-risk pregnancy and you need to go off-site, so you can't do your OBGYN appointment in the prison, you're going to have to be previously in past times shackled and taken to the off-site care facility, which is antithetical to good care for pregnant people or for anybody for that matter, for in my opinion, but we're talking about pregnant folks here. So they'll be taken off-site with shackles on. And I think that what our bills are getting at is that we want to remove shackling during transport completely. And we would like to never have a woman shackled in hospital or shackled upon an exam. And so it's the custody things that sort of interrupt the care, the standard of care for the women. And it's also healthcare in prison. There's a lot of people to serve, and there are lots of steps sometimes to get the care that you need. And some people don't know how to be their own best medical advocates. So the Michigan Doula Prison Doula Initiative is in a memo of understanding with the Department of Corrections, and they have been offering doula services, which has been also super helpful in getting education and care to the women. And we want to see this codified so that that never goes away, that women are getting more information about pregnancy, that they understand the labor and delivery process, that they are aware of high risk things that are going on. And I mean, any person in prison who's pregnant, it's basically a high-risk pregnancy. And so we want that kind of care. We also, the bills also include allowing infant to be in arms with the parent once the delivery happens.
Why is it that women who are, that folks who are in prison, that their pregnancies are necessarily high-risk? Is it because of just the standards of living are not in line with what doctors understand to be a normal pregnancy?
Yeah, and it's also, so when you're in prison, access, and people are going to argue with me, like state officials might argue with me, but the quality of food in prison is substandard. It's high in sodium. It is overly processed. There's very little fresh fruit. There, as far as I understand, never fresh vegetables. It's all canned.
It sounds like a recipe for preeclampsia.
Yeah. And there are times when custody is, it's about security. Prisons are about security. They're not about necessarily coddling people or taking good care of people or being gentle with people. And so, and I'm not saying that pregnant people need to be coddled, but I'm saying we need to be gentle with one another. And prison is opposite of that. It is, they're sleeping on a thin cushion and they are in very close confinement. And there's multiple people around, and it's so prisons are always either overcrowded or you're isolated. There's not any sort of normal sort of living. And the other piece of the why it's a high-risk pregnancy is that usually the criminal legal process is an incredibly stressful reality. Mm-hmm. And so they've already been through all of these stressors of going through to jail, through the courts, then getting moved into prison, and potentially many women who are ending up in prison have also been drug users. And so they have this other high risk factor that they've been using drugs. And then a judge, mostly in a paternalistic way, is like, well, you need to go do time. And you're going to be safer here in this prison context than you would be out on the streets. And we think that that's ridiculous, but it's what's been happening up until COVID when people are not entering prison like they were. And so we think these bills are important to make sure that there's good care. And then also the 831 is actually an oversight bill for the whole women's prison.
Can you talk to us about what happens during after delivery for people who are in prison? Like, how long are they allowed to have access to their babies?
So it's been on average about 24 hours that they have access to their babies if it's a vaginal birth. And then 48 hours if it's a C-section. The bill would make that a longer period of time, and the discretion would be up to the OBGYN, the treating physician, to have potentially longer care in hospitals so that there can be more bonding, because we know that skin-to-skin contact actually mitigates the trauma that the infant has already been through in utero through the entire criminal legal process. And so we're pushing for skin-to-skin and changing that 24 to 48 hours to make it potentially a little longer. And then the baby is either given to a guardian that has been arranged with a social worker in advance, or is taken by the state if Child Protective Services has been involved, or if there's no guardian to give the infant to.
Have these bills been a tough sale in Lansing?
So far, not totally a tough sell. We're working on them. I think that there's support. I think that people understand that we need humane treatment of pregnant people in prison. I also think that there's an understanding among the legislature and the state, the DOC, that the women's prison has been chronically overcrowded for the last many years, and that having expert eyes through the Corrections Ombudsman's office on the prison so that they can report out to the legislature what's happening there is a good thing. It's transparent government. It's not a bad thing. And the public needs to know what happens in our prisons because we pay for them. So I think that it'll move through. It's just been some negotiating and a lot of work over the last 2 years with stakeholders to make sure that the people who've experienced pregnancy and birth in prison and the women who are held there in general have had a say in the formation of these bills. I mean, I think about the women's prison is that there are a lot of people held there, and it is an older facility, and the structural integrity is problematic. And I think that if folks understood that, like on the West Side, people are living two women in a wet cell, right? So there's a toilet in there and there's a sink, and then you have to like go to the bathroom in front of your bunkie who could be a complete stranger. Like, I don't think people understand that that's the reality that hundreds of women are living in Michigan. And so I'm hopeful that these bills can sort of flip that up inside out, and we can see that prison is a place of punishment. It's a place of control. And is this really what we want to do in dealing with harms in our communities? And let's start with women who are usually like end up in prison at lower rates, except they've been on the rise lately, because they're a smaller population that we can deal with, and turn this prison inside out and let the public see what's happening.
Natalie Holbrook directs the Michigan Criminal Justice Program for the American Friends Service Committee. Natalie, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, April, for having me.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Coming up, the evolving landscape for collegiate esports. It offers a lot of promise from gamers who are into NBA 2K or League of Legends and everyone in between. We'll talk about how collegiate and pro teams are tackling esports.
COVID shut down sports for, you know, half a year. And I think the ability to be able to still engage with a student body and, you know, have your brand out there as a university, esports was a vital tool for that.
That's after a short break here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Recall, if you will, the thrill of that first time you just buried your brother at Mario Kart. Or perhaps, if you're of a certain age, first time you beat the high score on Pac-Man at your local arcade. Gaming has come a long way since then, competitive gaming especially. It is gaining the legitimacy that it well deserves as a sport. Here to talk to us about the rise of esports around the globe and some new developments here in Michigan is Norris Howard. He's head of collegiate esports content at Beasley Media, and he's the host and producer of the podcast Checkpoint XP, coming to us from Detroit. Norris, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, how's it going? Happy that we could talk about something super fun this time instead of doom and gloom.
Indeed. And also with us from Kalamazoo, Scott Schroeder. He's director of visualization at Perkins Will, sports architecture firm that helps their clients understand the esports scene. Scott, nice to hear your voice. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about the world of esports and gaming.
We should probably start with definitions. Esports is just this umbrella term for various games that are out there. You know, the big ones that people know about, League of Legends and Overwatch, are very different than, say, your sports video games like Madden or NBA 2K. Scott, you came into sports architecture sort of through gaming. Will you tell us a little bit about how those two came together for you?
This all started back when I first started playing games. It was Duke Nukem 3D. And I got into using their level editor program, and I instantly loved it. And I knew I wanted to be in sort of the computer-generated creation world. So I went to Purdue University, and they had a program that not only did computer generation, but they also did it for architecture. And it mixed the two loves of my life. And so that's how I got into all of this and ended up at Perkins of Will, the Denver studio, which is the sports architecture firm. And esports came about, and it was just a perfect mix of the three things that I love to do now are all rolled into one.
Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of clients who've been interested in the work and just sort of what kinds of assurances and information they need from you?
We have had a healthy mix of both university clients and sort of the community rec clients, so installing a esports lab inside a community center. You know, some of the assurances that we try to give them is that it's a viable opportunity. Esports is definitely here to stay. It's only going to get much, much, much bigger. We try to help them understand their needs for networking, what types of computers, you know, they need to install, and understanding internet requirements and things like that. So that's what we really try to do. And we let them sort of make their own decisions on what games to install or what to do on that.
Norris, it feels like there was a period where esports was something that smaller schools were taking very seriously. But, you know, the University of Michigan, MSU, thought, well, you know, maybe we have enough draw for our student body that we don't need to take this as seriously. What do you think was the game changer? Do you think people at some of the bigger schools started seeing there are these huge festivals happening all over the world? This is for real? Or what gives?
I think it was a combination of that and simply the pandemic. I mean, COVID shut down sports for, you know, half a year. And I think the ability to be able to still engage with a student body and, you know, have your brand out there as a university, esports was a vital, you know, tool for that. And even though play slowed down during the summertime, as it usually does for all collegiate sports, I think it was a good way for a lot of those larger schools to still sort of stay relevant. Because as you said, the smaller schools are really who are, you know, going out there and winning the big tournaments. A school like Maryville or Harrisburg University, these are two really medium-sized and small-sized universities that usually would be no parts of a athletic conversation, but dominate the esports world. So a lot of the big schools are playing catch up to the smaller schools when it comes to esports.
Western Michigan in Kalamazoo, where Scott's coming to us right now, has a program that's been around for a while. Eastern got its program up and running a few years ago. And now here we are in this time when the University of Michigan has announced its own competitive program. I mean, I was shocked to hear that this might have some branding implications for universities, Norris. But to what extent has it been student-led? I mean, how long have people in some of these programs been advocating?
I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, esports essentially is born on college campuses. I mean, if you go back, you know, to the old arcade days, and almost all of us who have gone to college in the past 20 years know that there was a group of kids who, you know, went to the student union or a student center or certain dorm rooms, and people played video games, whether it was, you know, Call of Duty or Street Fighter or any of those games. And so the energy behind a lot of these programs and a lot of these teams have grown out of student organization. Almost all esports varsity teams began as student organizations or clubs. And so, you know, the big push right now is to get those clubs to move into the varsity point where they could get funding from the university, they could have faculty support, and they could start raising some money in order to be competitive with some of these programs that have already gone all in.
You know, the first thing that came to my mind when I heard that more of the bigger schools were getting involved is just, okay, so players don't necessarily need to be in college to play games. You know, they can even make a pretty good living for themselves if they can get attention on Twitch. What is the benefit to playing esports at the collegiate level?
You know, as it goes with traditional sports, not every kid will make it pro. Not every kid necessarily has the desire to be a professional gamer. But if you have the ability to pay for your education at a school like the University of Michigan or, you know, Akron or Ohio State or any of these other schools, of course, it's an avenue that I think many kids would take. I mean, and it's also a way to justify your gaming habit to your parents. I mean, if you go to mom and dad and say, hey, U of M offered me a $50,000 scholarship, I mean, who's going to say no to that?
Scott, do you think there are any other pieces to this for the gamers themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what Nora said, you know, it's you find other avenues, and maybe you might be a good player, good enough to get a scholarship at the University of Michigan, and then you learn from great players and that boosts you to pro. I think that's an amazing opportunity. Or as you're getting that education, as we're seeing a lot of schools are developing academic programs around esports, you start to say, well, I want to be a broadcaster, or I want to be in the next video game developer and make the next video game. Or sports medicine is becoming huge in esports. And so you become,
You need to unpack that for me. Is it the worst of all carpal tunnel syndrome possibilities?
Yeah, carpal tunnel, eye strain, headaches, back pain, posture. I mean, it's amazing at the sports med. And you don't think about sports med and esports, but it's huge.
Yeah, and just to piggyback on that, you know, the University of California, Irvine, has a full-time sports psychologist on staff for their esports team. And so you have a lot of kids who are, you know, moving to Southern California away from their family, away from their friends. A lot of them are international students. And, you know, that has a effect on your psyche. And then you have your normal studies compounded with having to play at a high level. And so Scott's absolutely right. You know, a lot of these kids are finding avenues outside of the field of play or the particular game that they're really enjoying with esports. The marketing people, the branding people. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff, networking folks, and architecture, like Scott himself. So a lot of the kids are discovering that as they have their journey through collegiate esports. And I think it's amazing. I think it's one of the best things to happen to college campuses in a long time.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Norris Howard. He's the host of the podcast Checkpoint XP and writes about esports content for Beasley Media. We also have Scott Schroeder with us. He's director of visualization at Perkins Will, a sports architecture firm that has been working with a lot of schools to beef up their infrastructure for esports. Norris, given how the NCAA has treated traditional athletes, should there be some trepidation about joining college teams?
You know, that's one of the most interesting sort of developments as we move forward and this thing begins to grow. Then I think the NCAA's reputation or notoriety, so to say, when it comes to student athletes has led to esports wholly rejecting the notion that NCAA should be involved at all. Right now, there is a litany of other organizations such as NACE, TESPA, a lot of third-party organizations that have loose affiliations with game developers that are running these tournaments that schools participate in. And the thing that I think is interesting about this is the fact that there really isn't any limits as to what a student athlete can do in terms of esports. They can flow between, you know, games freely. If they decide that they want to go pro, they have the ability to do so. They just can't play for scholarship money. It's just one of those things where it almost feels as if the player themselves are a lot more empowered to control their own destiny, as opposed to a lot of other student athletes in traditional sports who, as we see now, are just now lobbying and getting some traction on the ability to even monetize their own names.
Can we talk about the Pistons GT for just a second?
Of course.
How are the esports pro teams for the NBA and the NFL doing right now? Can you give us a sort of a check-in at this point?
It's interesting to see the development of the esports versions of real sports, because as it stands right now, while they are maintaining some popularity, they are still dwarfed by Dota 2, League of Legends, Counter-Strike, and other larger esports. And I think traditional sports has a real issue on their hands because that was supposed to be the way that they capture Gen Z. But the problem is that to play these games, you have to almost have a context and an affiliation for the traditional sport.
Right.
And as traditional sports begins to lose viewership with Gen Z and younger, they have a real problem with getting people involved with these games as well. And so I think they have to do a lot more in terms of highlighting some of the star players that participate in these esports tournaments for these sports. I think they have to do a lot more just really boosting the overall status of these particular tournaments. I think other esports have done a much better job at that.
Scott, what does it take to get a pro team up and running at a school? What kind of facilities are we talking about?
A lot of the schools that we have seen, the facilities that usually are used are the older arcades, pool rooms. They're underutilized spaces that are converted essentially into their esports area. And realistically, most of these spaces have enough power to power the computers. What really needs to be looked at in the school perspective when you're re-kitting these spaces is your networking. Your esports program will live and die by your internet and the network within the building. You know, if you're at a football game and the internet goes out, you can still watch the football, but maybe you can't tweet about the great play.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're playing Dota and the internet goes out,
you're done.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, the game's done. So the network is practically the most important piece of a program that no one will ever see, because it's going to be buried in the floor, buried in the wall, but it is the absolute lifeblood of any program.
I mean, the colleges that are involved in this on that level, I mean, would they have those kinds of problems? Have you ever seen that happen where it's in the middle of competition and all of a sudden the lights just go out?
I haven't seen it at the collegiate level, but the Overwatch League, while as they were playing from home this year, has had some high-profile players drop out due to random internet issues.
Ugh.
So it can definitely happen.
That sounds awful. The culture for every game is a little bit different. Tell us a little bit about some of the emerging groups that maybe had not even been served quite so much by traditional gaming before that are sort of finding their own in this environment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I alluded to it earlier. You have Gen Z, which is heavy into, you know, streaming, and mm-hmm. then vicariously is beginning to get exposed to more and more esports. I think that's one of the major, major cohorts that you see, is that esports skews so young, both in the players and in the viewership. But the viewership for esports is starting to get older. And what you're seeing is a lot of kids introducing their older siblings and parents to esports. And so that's an emerging cohort that you see. I think the Overwatch League for season one and two really tried their best to sort of make the viewing experience as close to a traditional viewing experience for, say, the NFL as they possibly could. Obviously, COVID-19 put a halt on a lot of what they were building, but they were doing home stands. It was a home and away style format where teams were traveling, people were going to a physical location to watch these games, fan experiences. It was actually really, really amazing to see that stuff happening. And another demographic that you're starting to see, especially in the streamer and the esports space, that they still need to do a lot of work on this, but a large percentage of gamers are women, and you're seeing more of an effort, and in my opinion, still not enough, but you're seeing more of an effort to reach out to female gamers and get them more involved at a competitive level as well as a viewership level, because there's no physical limitations to esports. So you really don't need to separate on the basis of gender in esports.
Isn't that more true overseas, though, than it is in the United States, that women are taking more of a position in the world?
Absolutely. It is definitely true in Europe. You're seeing it also in Asia as well. And one of the big things that you're seeing is a lot of women are taking roles behind the scenes, but they're not necessarily getting the same representation on the field of play. And so there's moves worldwide to try to change that. But you are correct. I mean, I think Europe and Asia are both leaps and bounds ahead of North America in this respect.
To your point, Norris, while it's certainly true that esports is something that many, many people watch and participate in at home, I have been in rooms where, you know, a bunch of people were getting together, you know, at a software developer's offices or, you know, some sort of social club environment in a bar to watch. And it's just like the energy in the rooms is really hard to describe unless you're talking about like double overtime in an NBA final. And here we are now with COVID just having taken a lot of steam out of that. Do you think that even though COVID is giving, you know, it has been a bit of a moment in terms of recruitment, do you think that it will be very long after the pandemic before we see that social experience with esports come back again?
Yeah, it'll be back for sure. And you know, as somebody who is helping putting these facilities together, I hope that Sad also has strong feelings on this, but I think it'll be back, and I think it'll be back strong. League of Legends right now, their world championships taking place in Shanghai. Obviously, they can't have big crowds, but this is something that drew 100 million viewers worldwide, as well as will pack 90,000 seat stadiums across the world for the grand finals. And so this is something that people already have been doing. I don't think 1 year will change the energy behind that. And I think in North America, you'll begin to see more energy behind it because gaming and streaming and all of it grew by quite a bit. And I think people now have discovered new communities that they want to be a part of. And next year, I can only hope and assume that these developers will be trying to leverage that.
Scott, how about you? Are you looking forward to getting back in a room with several thousand people to be able to watch competition?
Oh, absolutely. I miss the energy. I miss live. I miss high-fiving somebody when something cool happens. I'm absolutely looking forward to getting back in person.
Scott Schroeder is director of visualization at Perkins Will, a sports architecture firm. He works out of Kalamazoo. And we've also been speaking with Norris Howard, who writes about collegiate esports at Beasley Media. He also hosts the podcast Checkpoint XP. Scott, Norris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.